Would you like to accelerate your career and reach your full potential in just minutes a day? Welcome to the LeadX Show with New York Times bestselling author and Inc. 500 entrepreneur, Kevin Cruz.
So actually, Dan, and I've been excited to have this chat because I haven't done, well, we have, I looked this morning because we haven't released a LeadX leadership show in probably 3 months, and I've not hosted one in 6 or 7. So I'm coming out of the closet. I'm coming out of retirement here, you know, to like get back to the podcasting roots just because of you and your book.
You know, you are too kind. You really are. And you should be doing more of these. You're such a conversationalist. You're so well-read. You're a human being beyond human beings, man. Like, give me. The world needs more, Kev. Come on.
I think, you know, it really is true. Like, I was excited for your book, excited to get your message out there. And it's funny because from the start, like, not only are we both just like leadership geeks and into culture, but I mean, we talk about a lot of the same beats, you know, authenticity and feedback and drive and engagement. We both talk about love probably more than almost anyone I know in our business books. And so it always feels great to talk to you. And I guess other people would be like, don't put a spotlight on the competitor, you know? and it's like, what? Are you kidding me? This is amazing, amazing work. So anyway, and congratulations on yet another book. I know what it takes to get it done, of course.
It's just keeping me married, Kevin. As long as I'm writing and out of Denise's hair, because I have none. I tend to be in other people's hair if I'm not writing, and I can't travel anywhere, so I better keep writing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, Dan, even though I'm just going to do this podcast as a cold open into our conversation,
love it.
And instead of it having a more scripted feel, like I did tell you, I just want us to have like a great conversation wherever it goes and let people listen in, whether that's only going to be two people that find that interesting or many more. But to set the context for those folks out there who aren't familiar with your work or haven't heard us talk before, Dan Pontefract, you are the founder and CEO of the Pontefract Group, helping clients improve leadership and culture. You've got a ton of real world experience, though. Previously chief envisioner, chief learning officer at TELUS, $14 billion Canadian telecommunications company that has over 50,000 employees. We've talked previously about your previous books, Flat Army, The Purpose Effect, Open to Think, and your new book is Lead, Care, Win, How to Become a Leader Who Matters. It's amazing, right? Like, you've been productive, you've been busy.
You know, thanks, but really it's an outlet. I mean, some people box, some people go for long hikes. And I keep my fitness up with my bicycle and the gym downstairs, but writing is an outlet, Kevin. I mean, you do this, you just, you observe, right? And I'm a leadership geek. At the end of the day, I want tomorrow to be better for people than what they experience today. So if I can, whether that's pick up something with the literature I write, like your books, like Handy, like Drucker, like Nilufer Mershon, you name it, right? I'm an observer, and we're all on the path of the waterfall. So if I can summarize and maybe provide a little bit of glib hope and opportunity, I'm happy to do it.
That's awesome. Now, because before I derail the conversation and forget to do it at the end, if people want to find out more about your work, more about this book, how they can get in touch with you, what are all the best ways?
This book, I think, is probably the easiest. It's called Lead, Care, Win, and go to leadcarewin.com. It all goes to the same spot, a little microsite, but, Twitter, LinkedIn, obviously all the other social media channels, but leadcarewin.com, and take it from there.
Perfect. So the first thing I noticed right away was the design of this book. I mean, it is so cool and different than what you've done before. I've not done a book like this. And you talk about how as you were writing the book, you had Michael's book out, right? The Advice Trap, or maybe it was the first one, The Coaching Habit, as kind of the inspiration or the model. Am I getting this right?
You absolutely have that right. You know, I think the three of us, Michael, Kevin, and Dan, seem to have been created from the same forces of parental sponsorship, albeit in three different countries between Australia, the U.S., and Canada. But yeah, I had the coaching habit in front of me, literally to the right when I was writing from the office. And then he went and sent me, of course, a way early an alpha copy of the advice trap.
Yeah.
And it was sort of almost solidified there. Yeah, I think this is exactly what I need to do. And Michael's just, he's such an innovator. He's a geek, but he's such a truthful, honest person. And I thought, you know what? If he's doing that for leaders and for people to become, you know, better coaches ultimately, well, maybe I could do something different. Do I have to write that 85,000 word hardback book again?
Right.
Or maybe, you know, paying homage, I should say, to Michael, maybe I could create more like a field guide that has humor, that is punchy, that's only 37,000 words, that's only paperback, you know, that's bolded and has call outs, and it just is way more than any of the other three books, to be dead honest, practical.
Yeah. I'm fascinated. Well, I've always had sort of, I don't want to say like an eye for design, but an interest in design, a curiosity about design in any objects in the world. And, you know, as a writer, I've often been disappointed with, my publishers and previous book efforts. You know, most books are just boring, right? They're just words on a page. And, Michael certainly stood out, and I think was one of the first in our sort of, you know, leadership area to do it. Field guide's a good way to put it, because I'm looking at your book and trying to be mindful of those who might be listening. As you said, I mean, first of all, just the size, it's more portable. People can stick it in a handbag or stick it in their backpack really easily. It's got a good feel to it. The attention to detail on the inside cover. And this is a thing. First of all, most people aren't reading books anymore. You know, right. I really do worry about this. So it's like, you know, where are the five people that are going to want to read a book? You know, and those people out there who read, so many, including myself, are just doing the Kindle or the ebook version. Yeah. And I feel like having a book in this kind of a format, it almost becomes like a souvenir. You know, there's a reason not to buy this on Kindle. And for anyone out there, go ahead. If you want to buy a Kindle, buy 10 copies on Kindle for Dad. Don't not buy a Kindle if you prefer it. But it's that kind of book that you really enjoy. It's kind of like an experience to read it. It looks great sitting out on your desk. It's a great gift book. Like, man, like if you're looking to give a book to your clients out there, this is the thing to buy and ship at, you know, American Thanksgiving or the holidays at the end of the year. And I know I will write other books, but like I will have to do this kind of style. So when I do it, I'll have Michael's on the left and yours on the right as like the inspiration. But how much of the design did you get involved in? Like, were you sort of indicating where you wanted a call out or how to lay out a certain page? How much did you do?
Great question. And to the earlier comment about publishers, I couldn't agree more. You know, what often happens, I feel, in the author kind of publisher contract space is that it's a bit, it's a bit hierarchical, and it's sort of antithetical to what you and I write about and work with organizations about. And that's sort of the collegial, flat, if you will, collaborative approach. You know, the antiquated way of, you know, write your manuscript, send it in. Thank you very much. We'll tell you when it's published.
Right.
We'll give you a couple ideas on a cover, you know, but we're really in charge.
Right.
I don't get it. That is not what I believe in. So, you know, I've punted around different publishers from Wiley, et cetera, and I just realized I needed boutique and I needed someone that would be able to have conversations about what, you know, this could end up being. So long story short is I knew what I wanted to do from the get-go. I wanted it to be different. I wanted it to be sort of my Sergeant Pepper. Now, I'm not the Beatles. What I'm saying is, you know, the Beatles were like, oh, we don't tour anymore. We've done the records that are Revolver and Rubber Soul. We've done all those, you know, love albums, if you will. we got to do something different. And they completely reinvented themselves and created a fictitious band called Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And then they created an album around that. And so when I was working with the publisher, and particularly Jess Sullivan, who is the designer, you know, I was working on the premise that I would create habits, kind of like the coaching habit, but lessons, leadership lessons. And they fluctuated, Kevin, from, you know, there were 7, there were 18, and I finally whittled them down to 9 for a reason. And that was, I love the number 9. I think that's a striker in soccer wears number 9 often. And so I love that number. But more so, it just sort of fell into the 9. And then when we started thinking about things like, well, what are people doing these days on their phones? Well, they scroll a lot, they text a lot. Oh, there's a lot of emojis. So it was like, oh, each of these lessons need its own emoji to signify what, you know, the lesson is, whether it's embrace change, be relatable, what have you. But then I thought, well, they're all connected. So could you have, you know, a singular central graphic that actually united all 9 of the lessons? And the book is written so you could read lesson 8 first and go back to 1. Like, it's not sequential, but nonetheless, they needed to be unified. So emojis, unifying graphic, field guide, and then each chapter was written kind of blueprinted the same way. You know, whether it's introductory story or something that sets it up, what's the problem? Then I hit people with, this is why you're not being curious, or this is why you're not championing others. Questions to existentially ask yourself.
Right.
Then here are basically the tips, the techniques. And then I summarize it with the, well, here's what you should be doing. And that's kind of a bolded kind of a takeaway end of chapter. You could cut it out and carry it with you in your wallet or your purse. So every of the 9 is the same. But here's the other thing. So I'm a recovering chief learning officer, and I've seen way too many horrible, experiences in my life. And so, not only did I want the book to be practical and finally write something that was useful to anyone and everyone, but I wanted it to have an accompanying online program.
Yeah.
So from the very get-go, I created the book like an instructional design doc.
It's great.
And so coming out, I mean, it sounds like I'm upselling now, but just so you understand,
please,
this, right? Yeah. But coming out at the end of October is a 15-hour online leadership development program called Lead Care Win. And now, so each of the 9 lessons has 3 components that's available online. There's the core course, there's supplemental bonus material, we call it, and then there's the assessments and the kind of the curated extras. And then, so it was fun. So this whole project was write a book, but simultaneously write a learning program. And, you know, no one's seen it yet, so it could be crap, but I'm more interested to those folks that are human resource officers, chief learning officers, et cetera, who are thinking, oh, I remember that book. Oh, there's an online program as well. Fantastic. Or vice versa. They're looking, an individual is looking for something like, oh, it comes with a book. Great.
Well, and I think I was going to actually talk about the course and the structure. So you walked right into that for me, because when you open up the book and you see the table of contents again, and it's all visually, it's beautiful. But you don't call them chapters. They're lessons. And so, you know, we don't have time to go deep into all these, but just so the listeners know, you know, lesson 1, be relatable. Lesson 2, play for meaning. Stay present. Remain curious. Embrace change. Lesson 6, dare to share. Command clarity, commit to balance. Lesson 9, champion others. And so the book itself, you know, is like a course. You can go through it, and you really, as you said, can go to any lesson that interests you. But it's like a leadership course. And then for those who really want to dive in more deeply, or for heads of leadership development, engage employee experience, whatever, for those who want to provide something maybe through their learning management system, their LXP, they can do the digital course as well, or separate from the book, right?
Absolutely. I mean, just you. I mean, you're just so clever and smart that you're, I believe, if I'm not correct, the first to pick up on this, that I didn't call them chapters. They're literally called lessons. And that one word change
right.
signifies something, I hope, to the reader, that the reader is a learner.
Yeah.
And that the learner has the opportunity to certainly, you know, learn from the book, but then there's another Pandora's box to open should they want a hell of a lot more. Yeah. I mean, to be honest, like and I'm so excited. Like, honestly, you can see how giddy I am. I've never done anything like this before, right? I mean, I've done it at TELUS and SAP, but not Dan Inc., if you want to call it that. But I recorded between the middle of May to last week, indeed, 76 videos.
Wow.
And they range from 3 minutes to 20, but they make up, you know, a predominant portion of what is that kind of 15 hours. And so, yeah, of course, there's activities, exercises, self-reflection, you know, flip the cards, you know, knowledge checks, and, you know, other bits. But 76 videos that accompany the 9 lessons. So what is that? Roughly 8 videos per lesson, roughly, right?
Yeah,
It's a lot of fun.
So the peer-to-peer questions keep jumping in my mind. So how did you do this video production, especially in, you know, time of you're not putting together a big video production crew and bringing them into your living room, right? So did you do it through like a Zoom type thing like this, or did you set up a little studio in your home? How'd you do it?
Well, I suppose it goes back to, I have to remember my own lesson numbers. Lesson number 4, remain curious. When this all went down, I had written most of the book. We went into editing when the pandemic really fell off a cliff there in mid-March.
Yeah.
So I was able to slot in a few kind of pandemic related anecdotes and, you know, flexible work from home, et cetera. But yeah, around the beginning of May, I went into, all right, well, I was always in the cars to do this. It was going to be done elsewhere, but now I'm going to do this from home. So I became both the key grip, the sort of men and women in black at the back of the, you know, the auditorium when you do your keynotes, Kevin. So those technicians, I became the designer, and I did it kind of all, I'm dating myself, but I Magnum PI'd and MacGyvered myself all in one, into what happened. So long story short, Denise and I built a house, moved into it last year. We knew we wanted a very kind of large office. We're sitting in that one today as we speak here today. And I had set up already, thankfully, a huge wall mounted screen. And so I thought, okay, I'm looking at that screen in this office. I'm thinking that could act as kind of like the over the shoulder way in which to convey a slide or two. Like I'm a big graphic guy, right? And so then I'm on the hunt for kind of the best cameras and what you could have. So I ended up purchasing 2 so I could have 2 shots.
Oh, look at you.
Yeah.
2 camera shoot.
Exactly. And then I learned everything I possibly could learn about Adobe Premiere.
Yeah.
And I became post-production as well. So
amazing.
It was honestly, I had a blast. I really enjoyed it. Both from an instructional design perspective, from filming. And a lot of it's extemporaneous.
Yep.
So, you know, there's a picture, there's a couple things. I tell the stories, help provide a little bit more context that's not in the book. And then off we went. And I hired obviously a courseware development firm to put the whole thing together. Yep. We created our own, platform. We're not using Thinkific or Udemy. It's like leadcarewin.com.
It's pretty bold.
Yeah. Just going for it. Well, I'm in your vapor trails, man, because that's exactly what you've done already. You've created your own platform, and you know, I'm just living in your vortex, man.
Well, hopefully you'll be a little further along 3.5 years from now than where we are today. But, I've done the studio shoots, and I've done the, by myself home shoots, and I've had the crew in my home. I've done it all.
Yeah.
And what I think people don't realize, and I've done that thing where I had the big TV to my side as like showing the slides.
Yeah.
And you're bringing it all back. This is probably 4 or 5 years ago that I was doing that shoot in my house. And it seems so easy when you see it done. If you just see, oh, there's probably Dan standing in front of his monitor talking in their slides. I remember when I was shooting, it would be like, wow, look at the glare on that monitor. Like, how do you get the lights? Totally. So you're lit up, but there's no glare on the monitor. That's a problem. And then if you're in a room that has windows, well, the light in that room is different in the morning than the afternoon or when that big cloud goes by. The audio isn't great when the trash truck or the lawn mowing people show up or whatever, right? And I just remember it would frustrate me to no end. And I think at one point I finally just said, okay, like I'm supposed to be relaxed and energized and focused on the content. And I'm raging inside over like all the production things. Like, I can't do this. Like, I gotta write a check to my buddy Adam and have him come in here and set this up and run it for me. So hopefully you were a little more calm than I was because it wasn't a good experience.
You're inculcating, sense of PTSD I'm still feeling from the entire experience. Well, I just, you know, the way you vividly describe it, indeed, you know, really well-lit room that where this kind of home studio was. But yeah, the garbage truck, the sunlight difference. And I'm not a good-looking man. I don't even have hair like you do. So imagine a fully bald guy with the different, you know, light shots. You're trying to not refract the lens so you blind someone for the 4 minutes they look at a video.
You're quite a handsome chap, but perhaps you had some glare issues that I wasn't thinking about back then.
Definitely, I can assure you that, my friend.
But you know what's interesting to me, among many interesting things about 2020, I can remember years ago being a little self-conscious about that of like, geez, you know, I know authenticity sells and all that kind of stuff, but like, you know, I'm filming myself in my home. How's this going to play out? And I was jealous of some friends, who were doing they were doing their courses through, say, LinkedIn, and others were, I think, Creative Live. And there's like, oh, I'm flying to LA and I'm in this big sound stage and I'm this, you know, there's 18 people around me filming me do this lecture. It's like, okay. And you might know them too. I was talking to like Dory Clark in New York, Alyssa Cohn. They're doing LinkedIn things and they are shooting themselves from their own homes. And so, It's leveled the playing field. And apparently, you know, Dory had her, strategic thinking was the number two most popular LinkedIn. Once again, showing it's about content. It's about delivery. It really isn't about production values. And I mean, if you're LinkedIn and you're thinking, wow, we used to spend $40,000 in production costs filming all these experts. Maybe we should just keep telling them to film themselves at home when this is all done. I don't know.
You are so onto something, and I'll answer it analogously, because I've done a couple TV bits over the last, since the pandemic, based on, you know, my work from home, remote work experience that I've got working at TELUS, et cetera. Anyway, the point is this. I remember when, back in the day, pre-pandemic, Kevin, you know, the television studios wouldn't ever want you on their show unless you were in studio. Mm. And so nowadays, whether you watch CNBC or Fox, it doesn't matter. There are so many now interviews being done with people in their homes.
Right.
Because either, you know, the Wi-Fi is caught up. I mean, for me, I've got fiber optic to the home, so it's fabulous. Or, you know, I guess the television producers have said, well, what else are we going to do? No one can come into the studio, so we might as well open this up. So I think what's happened is society has almost grown up and said, yeah, you know what? It's a little grainy, but I like what they're saying.
Right.
Back to your point about content. So I love Dory, right? And I get her stuff always so good. And again, because she's in her flat there in Manhattan, doesn't even bother me. Doesn't occur to me that she's, I mean, it's into the flat and I know what kind of what it looks like. Yeah. But the point is, it's Dory. She's so great. I could care less about, you know, if I hear a doorbell go off in mid-interview, like it's no big deal.
Yeah. It was pre-pandemic. I remember maybe it was just a year or 18 months ago. There was sort of a viral clip of someone who was at home as the expert talking to the news broadcaster. I can't remember who it was. And their little daughter came in, or son came into the room, opened up the door, came in the room, ran around. And everyone thought that was hilarious. And it went viral that this thing, you know, bombed the newscast. No one would think 2 seconds about that now, because everybody's doing it from home. The dog walks by, the cat jumps up, whatever it is. we're all doing that. And I don't
think we're all doing that.
Even if people do start to go into the studio, half the people go back to work or whatever. I mean, in our lifetime, nobody's going to really think twice about people who are working from home or any of those things.
Not at all. And yeah, it was about 3 years ago. It was BBC. It was a Singapore professor, and his three-year-old popped into the room, right?
You know this cold. This is amazing. Yeah.
And then the nine-month-old, who is in a walker, follows his sister in, and then his wife, like just 10 seconds later, comes like flying in, and she's grabbing the two children by like essentially the necks.
Right.
Whilst the BBC reporter is like, oh, I guess you've got something going on back there. But yeah, these days, like it is old hat, right? I mean, and again, think about, I know like there's about a new TikTok every day.
Yeah.
Of the kindergarten teachers teaching their children. And it's so heartwarming and embracing. But just, you know, again, think about all of the professionals, the adults, the teachers who are now teaching from home and what they're doing to ensure of the engagement with their class. Yeah. I mean, it is the great equalization, if you will. We're all in this together, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to, I do want listeners to hear a little bit more about the book. And I thought, I would ask you some sincere questions that like, thoughts I had in my head about a couple of things. And, you know, what can you tell the story? You had a student once, a long time ago, named Kaylin.
Oh, yes.
That you tell. Can you tell that story for us?
Absolutely. Kaylin Slezak. So to set this up, I have left high school teaching. So I got out of university, thought I was going to be a high school teacher, lasted 2 years, went back to do another degree, a quick one, kind of took me a year and a bit. And then I pitched the dean of computing at the Institute of Technology where I was about to live in British Columbia, that they had this new campus downtown that had just opened with no one in it, that he should give me the keys to it so that I might welcome career changers into these really cool programs. This is circa 1998.
It's great.
So Kaylin is one of the team members of a class of about 25 who's taking a one-year program called Information Technology Professional. And what that basically means is they were learning both the technology skills to sort of, you know, be either in business development or IT administration, but also the leadership skills. So on Fridays, I waltz in on Friday afternoons to sort of summarize the week, provide some context, but also usually use that as moments of inspiration or motivation or challenge about a particular leadership topic. And so I don't even remember what we were talking about this particular Friday, but it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It's about a 90-minute session. And I'm, as is my style typically when I'm either facilitating or teaching, I walk around a room. I'm not at the front. And so Kaylin is situated in the back left of the room of these 25 folks. And we're discussing whatever it is. And then Kaylin, I always get choked up about this. I never told the story publicly, just in the book for the first time. And I did reach out to Kaylin and say, could I tell this story? He's like, you're kind of amazing and absolutely. So thank you, Kaylin, publicly. So he chimes in, and I, at this point, am also 27 years old. Now, that I'm not saying age was the factor. It was my egregious, almost disdain for the comment that Kaylin made, and ultimately me not thinking about someone's humanity. And so after the comment happened, I was being glib. I thought I was being funny. I literally put my hand up, motion towards his face, and I said, Kaylin, just talk to the hand right now. And I didn't really know what I was doing. It was a moment, clearly a moment of error, but I didn't know it was an error at that particular point. And we carried on with the lesson. And, you know, 30 minutes later, I'm back in the office. And 1 minute after that, there's Kaylin in the doorway. And he comes in. He's like, Mike, come in. And I'm like, absolutely. He's like, he shuts the door. I said, I'm not sure what you just did, if you understand what you did. But here's how I saw it. And he breaks down the situation. And I was not only humiliated, Kevin, I mean, I lost a piece of me that day because I recognized that as I was going for the humor and the glib kind of comment and looking for the attention of the 24 other people, I completely forgot about Kalen's humanity and what he needed to be as a learner, which was to process out loud. And so when Kalen called my BS out in the office, you know, a minute later or so, I broke down. And I remarked to myself, I said, I know I've been treated that way before by others. What the hell am I doing? And so obviously I profusely apologized to Kalen. I then, on the Monday morning, I apologized to the class to make sure that they knew that I had been thinking about this. And Kalen came forward and pointed it out to me. But I share the story in the book because, again, I believe we're all practitioners. And if I was just an author who was taking stories from everyone else and not saying that I've screwed up and that I've learned over my lifetime to be ideally a more caring type of leader, then I'm not really an author, am I? I'm a puppet describing other people's situations. So there's a few kind of personal stories in the book itself because of my tenure in these sort of leadership roles. And that was, thank you for reading the book because that shows me you got near the end.
Dan, so here's the thing about the Kalen story, man. It hit me on a lot of different levels. And so one, and again, I want the listeners out there to know that like your book is filled with these kinds of stories from your personal life, often where you learned a lesson or would like to have done something different. So congrats on, again, that vulnerability as an author. My last book is the best I've done with that, but it's an ongoing journey. And yes, I know there's still like stories I won't tell until my father passes away or something, like, you know, because I worry about how different people will interpret stories. And so like you're the best writing is when the writer pretends nobody else is going to read it and all that kind of stuff. So the vulnerability you have throughout this book is great. It was also amazing that Kalen at that age and moment was able to have some kind of courage to come up and talk to you about it. Like most people, I think would put their tail between their legs and just, you know, go away or complain about you behind their back. And I want to make sure everybody knows, like, I totally agree with what you want us to take away from the story. And like on my best days, I want to remember everyone's humanity. I want to treat everybody with respect. I want to remember that if I'm in a coaching, leading, speaking, boss role, whatever it is, you know, I do have a certain obligation to people on the team, people around me. You can tell there's a butt coming. you know, and I on my best days, like I truly believe in, like, you know, Buddhist interbeing, you know, like there, but for the grace of God, go I. Like, so I, even when someone's and could be an enemy or is being mean to me, I don't really take it that personally. Having said all that, on another level, I wonder if like you seem very sensitive, like you this emotion, you're still hurt by this. You still have trouble with this all these years later. And at what point, so what, I believe this Kalen story, this was your reaction and what you learned from it is appropriate. When would it be okay for a teacher, a manager, a leader, a parent to be like, you know what, like I want to express my emotional honesty that, you know, that's not right. When is it appropriate for someone like Kalen or a Kalen situation gets a hard lesson, like, hey, that wasn't an appropriate comment. You don't need to talk as much as you're talking, whatever that might be. I can't remember who the guest was that talked to me about, like, we're now living in an age of verbal Photoshop where nobody can be authentic and just say, like, I'm upset or stop or please, you know, no more. People are constantly self-monitoring, self-editing, and then putting a Photoshop version, an airbrushed verbal version out there. And I didn't have an answer. As I read, I'm like, I totally agree with Dan. This story, this is a great story. And when is it okay to express some frustration with those around us? When is it okay? You know, where's the line? I don't know. Is this, what do you think? Is it making any sense?
No, it does. It does. And I think for the particular story with Kalen, you know, what I want to make clear with you and the audience is I went for the joke at the expense of Kalen. And I don't think that's cool.
That's interesting. So humor never has to be, it really shouldn't ever be at the expense of someone else or a group.
That's effectively what happened in this particular situation. But I know where you're going and I'm with you. I still fully believe that constructive communicative feedback, whether with a little bit of humor and levity or punching to the face, is appropriate. You know, in the book, you know, when I say command clarity as one of the lessons, I'm asking leaders to not be wishy-washy, to not sit on a fence, either for a decision or for the feedback. And again, like there's a fair amount now, and I love the verbal photoshopping metaphor, by the way. And I don't want to ever see that, for sure. And that's not a caring leader. When you hide, when you have an inability to be forward and to remedy with clarity, if you will, I think that's just as big an issue as being an arse and making fun of someone in front of other people. Both of them are two different examples of not caring. But I will say that, you know, and you know this all too well, the arses, the asses, the jerks inside of the organization who are either making fun of people or berating people in front of others, making people feel like a horse's ass. That's got to stop. That's not very caring. That's lead scare win. that's the playbook these days, really.
Right.
You lead by scaring and then you win. That's not cool. But again, I fully understand what you're getting at. And that's the point of making sure there was a lesson called command clarity, that you have to have that clarity with your team and yourself. Otherwise, you kind of walk around and no one really sure where you stand. So if you're going to be a caring leader, you do have to have those blunt moments, my friend.
Yeah. And I'm glad you hit that, because people who know my story always say, you know, like, that's been one of my lifelong weaknesses. You know, I haven't commanded clarity. I haven't been very clear. I'm so high in agreeableness, personality trait agreeableness, that, you know, when I was in my 20s and didn't understand these things, I would withhold feedback all of the time. Oh, I don't want to hurt Dan's feelings. Oh, Dan, we go out for pints. It's, you know, I'll forget about this. Not a big deal. Or I don't want to make him mad and have him leave for a competitor, you know, that type of thing. And it was embarrassing, you know, late in my career when I realized that, you know, I'm ignoring people when I withhold feedback, and that doesn't feel good. People will leave you if you ignore them. You know, they're going to think that you don't like them if you ignore them. And it's better, to be clear, to be direct. They want to get better. And, as long as it's coming from a good place, a place of caring, a place of love, a place of, hey, I'm trying to help you in your career. I think that's fantastic. So I did like, that chapter. I could always use a good reminder on, that chapter too.
Well, I was going to cheekily say, Kev, that, you sound very Canadian. Me being Canadian, we know that, you know, the personality type up here north of the 49th is one that is kind of sheepish. You know, we don't want to upset anyone, so we better not bring it up. And that's, you know, something that is inferior leadership, quite frankly.
Yeah, the phrase about, now I'm forgetting, you know, all of a sudden I'm forgetting his name, the former CEO of Campbell Soup, but he says tough on standards, tenderhearted with people. So it's like, it doesn't mean this soft stuff is that you don't care about results or you don't care about the standards. It's just being tenderhearted, you know, with the communication. Yeah. Dan, I'm okay on time, but realize I'm having so much fun. I'm eating up your clock. Do you still have some more availability here? A few more minutes?
Rock and roll, man. I've got all the way to top of the hour.
All right. So now I'm going back to like talk and shop again, because I realized I was asking you about that design process for the book. And when I got your book, I first thought, oh, I think he's using Michael's publisher for this, but it's not, right? You guys are using different publishers. Why didn't you use his publisher? How did you end up with the publisher you used?
What a great question. Well, here's the funny story. The two publishers of which I was under consideration after leaving Wiley was page two, of which The Coaching Habit and The Advice Trap are with, and figure one. Now, both of those groups are based in Vancouver. Both of those groups came out of the ashes of a former publisher that kind of went belly up. And the two groups are essentially the same. And there is really no reason to this particular day for me to suggest to you that one is better than the other, because I know the two gals at page two that are running and founded it are fantastic. They're just fantastic. Trina, just amazing people. The people over at Figure One with Chris et al. Are fantastic. And they've both done it right. I couldn't have gone wrong, I would argue, and evidenced by probably, you know, The Coaching Habit and The Advice Trap has just but two on the page two catalog. There's others as well. Leanne Davies' book, The Good Fight, for example, is with page two. And so partially the reason with Chris and the team over there at Figure One was Jess. Jess, the designer, the thing with Figure One is the two types of books they do are business books and coffee table picture books.
Of course, because those are just natural to go together.
You think, right? Yeah. But so partially was with Jess Sullivan and the chief designer, they were publishing books about like cookbooks and picture history books. And so there's this kind of design arm. And I kept thinking to myself, well, that's really interesting. I like this Jess gal. And it kind of sealed the deal. And although Open to Think is a book that doesn't have a lot of per se design, Jess and I were talking about what the fourth book ultimately would look like eventually. And that's where she came. I mean, she just rocked it. She really helped out.
That's great. When it comes to book marketing, first of all, it's always hard to market books, hard to get attention for books. 2020, if it's not a political book, you know, with especially catering to one side or the other, like it's hard to get any air in media right now. What have you found? I mean, you're probably right in the middle of it still, but I mean, what have you found is working for authors, consultants, et cetera, who are trying to get some attention for their work?
Well, I mean, depending on what your bank account looks like these days, someone obviously, I took a decision to buy a whack of copies off the publisher at wholesale price, and I shipped them out. So I think now I've sent 800 copies.
That's great.
Of the book, right across the globe. And I do that as partially a gift, but also partially some of those folks I didn't know. You know, it's sort of an accompanying letter and say, this is a book that's needed for several reasons right now. A, you know, as we both know, engagement hasn't really improved in our organizations. B, oh, by the way, we seem to be all working from home and need a little bit of care in our leadership due to the pandemic. And C, last time I checked, there's some kind of, you know, interesting political situations across the globe, not just in the U.S., and that, you know, we might look for a little bit more hope from. So, 1, 2, 3, what do you think? And, you know, like you, I used to travel a lot, you know, 150,000 miles a year, I would argue, based on my miles accumulation status every year. So I miss that, but I don't miss the number of miles, but I do miss the face-to-face interactions. I really, really do, Kev. So trying to get the book into people's hands and having just great, deep conversations like this with you, with folks, if I can, has been part of the modus operandi. But I tell you, I thought I was tired traveling. I'm way more tired in these virtual chats at the end of the day. Because there's a lot of them, but it's more the, I don't know, I guess maybe I got something back when you could shake a hand and hug someone or get a laugh from an audience even and feel the palpable, visceral, goodness of humanity out there. So I think I'm getting actually more tired in this book launch than any of the other ones, to be frankly honest.
I could tell that from reading your book that you're much more extroverted than I am, because you tell great stories. You have more great stories. You're in more situations that stuff happens. And I tend to do more of my drinking of old fashions at home than in bars. But like, you've got some good stories. We won't go into them right now. New Orleans, the story at the very end of the book that happened in pubs or bars. And I think like Dan likes to travel and get out and meet people more than I do. I also want to say, you know, I took that quote from Doug Conant, who is, you know, an idol of mine. I just had a blank and I want to make sure I do justice. Tough on standards, tenderhearted on people. Another friend of mine launched a book this year, Brad Aronson. He gave the same advice. He said, you know, he's doing all the stuff you would hope to do, including digital marketing and things. But I think he said 500 or 600 books that he personally sent out, like with a note or signed or a letter or something. And I think a lot of aspiring or first time authors out there don't quite realize what they've gotten themselves into. You know, writing the book, if you thought that was hard, the year after, you know, signing all those copies, shipping them, you know, and the follow up, it's a lot of work. And it's the only other thing that if you had a few dollars, not, I don't mean you personally, people out there, I used to say that putting your book in those airport bookstores was probably the only marketing dollars that could pay off, especially if you do keynotes or something like that, or you're a consultant. And again, in 2020, you know, you're not getting the traffic in those bookstores the way you used to. And so it's definitely the more relationships you have that you can call upon, or the better you can make new friends, the better your book is going to do.
Well, funny you brought that up, Kevin, because again, certainly part of my original strategy a year ago for this fall, because the book came out 29th of September, was indeed that, you know, the airport bookstores, right, between North America and in the UK. And so that, and again, I'm happy to share what that cost would be for me. That $35,000 investment did not go through, because obviously with, you know, air traffic down by 85%, depending on what country you're in,
right,
it doesn't seem like a great investment. So I used some of those funds, A, to buy some books and ship more books around the planet, but also for the first time ever, I entered into some online advertising with LinkedIn specifically.
Oh, that's great. And
not sure about the return per se, but at least I know that, you know, this 2-week run had a bunch of different things I tried, and based on traffic to where the call out points were, seems to be at least making an awareness campaign go similar to what the airports might have had.
Yeah, that's great. I did that 3-month, $30,000 airport campaign for Great Leaders. And I think that it certainly got more attention than not being in there. Right. And I think people who aren't in the business, they don't realize, like, if you're in an airport bookstore and you see the bestsellers and all that stuff, they're there because of a marketing campaign put
product
in there.
Product placement. Exactly.
It's product placement. And if, again, for business authors, it makes a lot of sense. You know, that's where you would want to put, put that book. So, anyway, well, you know, the pandemic won't last forever. At least we hope not. So, you know, maybe on, book 5 or 6 or something, we'll see in those bookstores, again. Let me ask, you know, on a personal note, what has been, like, a leadership lesson that you've had, like whether it's it was someone who coached you, or whether it was a book, or just a training program, or something that really did have an impact on your own understanding of leadership, management, persuasion. Something maybe you're like, wow, I wish someone had given me this thing or this experience when I was 25 instead of whatever. What comes to mind?
Well, one of them for sure was when I switched from higher education at that Institute of Technology with Kalen. I spent about 6 years there. I went into the corporate world in a high-tech company. And the high-tech company had about 1,500 people at the time. It was a business intelligence company called Crystal Decisions. It eventually became SAP. That's how I ended up at SAP.
Yeah, I remember Crystal Decisions, yeah.
Yeah. So I was its, redundantly, I was its, worldwide global training director. I just love the fact they call me worldwide and global.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah. So I get there, I'm 4 weeks in, and I immediately got a new boss. And the reason I got a new boss is because the VP of services, I guess, was exited out. And next thing you know, they brought in someone from Washington. And so he had relocated to Vancouver, of which headquarters were for this company called Crystal Decisions. Now, again, still roughly 1,500 people. We're in services. I'm reporting in the VP who reports in a COO. And, you know, we're about 2 weeks in to his reign. So we're about mid-November. He began at the beginning of November. And he goes up to me one day. He's like, Pontefract. You know, first of all, it's Pontefract, but that's okay, Eric. It's good. Pontefract, come over here. Let's go for a walk. So we go for a walk around the hallways. He's like, I've been here 2 weeks, and I think you're great. You know, everyone says great things about you. Fantastic work so far. I just got a question about, you know, you've been here now 6 weeks. And I said, yeah. He's like, well, I was looking at your expenses. He's like,
oh. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I didn't think I actually put any in my head.
Yeah. Right?
And he says, you haven't been anywhere. I said, yeah, I know. I haven't been anywhere yet. He's like, you've been here six weeks. I said, yep. He said, are you aware that the team that you inherited to come into this organization has 30 people in it? I said, I did. Yes. And he said, are you aware that 10 of these people do not live in Vancouver? And I said, yes, I am aware. Now, this is circa 2002.
Yeah.
And I said, yes, I am very aware. He said, well, I checked your expenses, and it looks like you haven't actually been on an airplane to go say hi to them yet. And then I knew, right? It was just a moment, and I'm 30 years old at the time. And because I've only been really working local to the Institute of Technology, I hadn't thought about people who lived in other towns or worked in other towns. It was his message to say, you know what? Leaders lead. So go say hello, not just on a phone. You know, we didn't have Zoom or WebEx back then. It was just phones. So I knew what he meant right then and there. I said,
he had a funny way of saying it, though.
He did. I checked your expenses. But it was just, again, a really stark reminder that, again, humans need connection. And whether we can't travel in a pandemic or not, how are you going to reach out and, you know, the old, I think it was AT&T, reach out and touch someone?
Right.
And that's what he meant. And I got it. So, of course, then between November and the holiday season, I went to the UK. I went to Florida. I went to New Jersey. I went to Denver. And I went to Paris and said hello.
Okay. That's an awesome story. And now you'll really know I read this book. This isn't planned for the listeners out there. So I just picked up your book because I remembered this. So starting on the bottom of page one, so this is how important this is, this topic is, bleeds over into page two. I'm reading now for Dan. While we often hear the mantra that leaders are in the people business, something continues to be lost in the translation. Let me make it clear, colon, you're in the relationship business. Boom! And Dan's story right there brings it home. Look at that.
That's exactly it. You are a well-versed reader who can connect dots, Kevin. Good job.
Dan, I'll just hopefully, again, the benefit of any listeners out there who are still putting up with this conversation. So 1997, I'm 30 years old, and my little company gets acquired by a company that would become Conexa. And they were at that time modeled as a professional service firm. So they had a partnership model in place. I don't know, a dozen offices, maybe half a dozen offices throughout the United States. Right. Now, I was a horrible leader back then. I don't know why I did this, but I'm brand new. So they acquire my company. I'm now a partner. And all these people had been together. All these other partners have been together for a decade. Most of them are 40, 50 years old. And so I'm brand new and I decide, you know what? I'm going to go, I don't know how many employees they had. Maybe they had 200. I had 15 on my team, tiny, right? So I fly up to Boston just to meet those partners face to face, have lunch, and I fly back to Philadelphia. Then I fly to Chicago, have breakfast, fly back. I think I flew to Atlanta, maybe four, maybe five flights. All I was doing was like, hey, I'm Kevin. I'm the new guy. You bought my little company in Jersey. What do you guys do? How can I help? That's it. And I, one of the partners was the chief financial officer, and I went face to face and said, what's your biggest problem? How can I be a great partner for you? And he said, no one's ever asked me that before. He said, let me think about it. And I said, I bet high in your list is you hate chasing receivables. You want us to make sure clients pay on time. He's like, that'd be a good one. All right, great. This all took about a week. The following month, so this is the end of the year, they held their annual partnership meeting where the, I don't know, 40 partners or something, 50 partners would nominate and vote on who's going to be the 8-person steering committee for the year ahead. You see where this is going.
Yep.
I've been on the ground there for 2 months, not 10 or 20 years. I'm 30 years old. I'm not 40 years old. I've got 15 people, not 115 people. I was elected and put on that board among all those partners. And it caused such a ruckus among, I guess, the group who didn't vote for me. The CEO had to sort of say, hey, listen, you know, we're changing, we're evolving. We said the vote counts. But like a lot of people are like, how does this new guy get 1/8 of the steering of our firm that I've just put 20 years into, right? So the power, and I think even it was before Zoom, you know, before all of that. But even in this day and age of Zoom, when it's safe to do so, when it's safe to do so, nothing replaces breaking bread in person and having that relationship go like that. There's nothing that replaces it. So.
Well, and I concur. And it's also your wonderful example of who you are. You know, you're humane and you don't treat, it as a people transaction. It's a relationship to nurture.
Yeah.
And I think that's the lesson here. And so when it is safe to go back face to face, but even I know you're doing this now, we start off by saying, you know, I've been kind of pulled out of retirement to continue to nurture our relationship, you know, and what the audience isn't really hearing yet is I called out to Kevin months ago at the beginning of the pandemic and said, Kev, you know, I'm thinking of raising some money for those afflicted by the pandemic for Red Cross. Would you like to join us as a speaker at SpeakAid, which is just something I put together to help? And you're like, absolutely. And then you donated through LeadX, you know, sponsorship dollars. Like, you're the nurturer of relationships. And I think that's what the audience needs to remember is that it is not a transaction with you. And I can see now with your example, you know, 20 odd years ago or so, that you looked out and said, how am I going to build a relationship here? And the others who weren't tending to their garden of relationships were kind of looking bemused and befuddled at this kid called Kevin who got 1/8 of the voting share, but they were treating people as transactions, I bet you.
Dan, all I know is tonight I'm going to tell Christine that you said I am a nurturer of relationships, and she is going to laugh in my face.
Well, it's recorded.
Dan, this has been an incredible hour. I'm excited for your new book. I want everyone to go out and get it, leadcarewin.com. And don't forget, like, if you want to be better as a leader, if you want the leaders in your company to get better, there is a course that is coming out. By the time this podcast comes out, it will already be out. So make sure to follow up with that. And I just want to conclude and say that, you know, my longtime listeners know I always say, life is about making an impact, not making an income. And I love your personal declaration of purpose. You say, we're not here to see through each other. We're here to see each other through. So on that note, Dan, thanks. I really appreciate the time you gave us all today.
My brother from another mother. Thank you, Kevin.
Thanks, Dan.